You're listening to the Study Legal English podcast, the world's first legal English podcast, helping lawyers and law students become fluent in legal English. Hello and welcome to episode 40 of the Study Legal English podcast. I am your host, Louise, and in today's episode, we'll be looking at international law. International law is a huge area of law covering a broad range of topics, and therefore today's episode is just an introduction. We just scratch the surface of this vast area. We'll answer some questions like, what is international law? How does it work? Who does it involve? And as well as this, you'll learn some key legal English vocabulary in this area. Also, this is the final episode in the English Legal System Module 2 Sources of Law course, which you can access at studylegalenglish.com/podcast_courses. So if you're a podcast pro member and you've been following the course and taking the episode quizzes, then you can take the final exam and earn a certificate. Another point which I'd like to mention is that a couple of weeks ago, I went to a conference in Alicante, which was absolutely fantastic. And if you are signed up to the Study Legal English newsletter, you will have read about this. If you missed it, then of course, sign up to the newsletter, or you can go to the Study Legal English blog, which is available at studylegalenglish.com/study-legal-english-blog. And in the write-up, you will find lots of resources about studying and teaching legal English. As well as that, something else which is quite exciting is that Study Legal English has its first guest blog writer, Dimitri. He is a lawyer from Russia specializing in corporate law and with many years of learning legal English. So he's there to share his tips with you, and his tips are available on the blog, and he will be posting more blog posts in the future, so keep an eye on those tips. So let's get started. International law is nothing new. For centuries, states have sought transnational agreements with other states to foster peace and trade, and to reflect this, international law was traditionally only concerned with relationships between states. However, over time, new issues have arisen due to globalization, such as human rights issues, drug trafficking, terrorism, climate change, trade on a scale previously unknown, all of which need cooperation on a global level, and not just for states, but also for non-state actors too. International law has had to develop new international agreements, new international organisations, and new supranational organisations in order to meet such challenges. And nowadays, international law goes beyond simply governing the relationships between states, but it also applies to individuals, transnational corporations, and other non-state actors. It is important to distinguish between public international law, which primarily governs public relationships or relationships between parties which have some sort of impact on public matters, and private international law, which deals with primarily individuals and private bodies, and it's also known as the conflict of laws. Private international law deals with disputes arising due to a conflict of national laws. For example, imagine a case where a married couple want a divorce. In most cases, at least with regards to the law, this should be relatively simple. But imagine a case where the couple were married in one jurisdiction, lived in another jurisdiction, raised children in another jurisdiction, and owned property in another jurisdiction. In this case, which law should govern the divorce, the division of the property, the custody or the parental responsibility of the children. The jurisdictions involved may have conflicting laws, each saying a different thing, and private international law lays out the rules to deal with this. So just to make it clear today, we are dealing with public international law. There are three main areas of public international law. Firstly, the laws of peace, which deal with relationships between states in peaceful times in the absence of war. Secondly, the laws of war, which govern the relationships between states during wartime. And thirdly, the laws of neutrality, which deal with a non-participating state during wartime, a neutral state. Then, of course, we have the various sources of law. Article 38 of the International Court of Justice Treaty defines a number of sources of international law. There are firstly three principal sources, and these are international conventions, international custom, and general principles of law. That's international conventions, international custom, and general principles of law. So let's take a closer look at these three sources. Firstly, conventional law is the most precise form of international law. It involves written documents between states, and these documents have various names which you've probably heard of, such as treaties, conventions, protocols, declarations, charters, and agreements. Lots of different names. We can imagine these agreements to be a little bit like contracts or even statutes which set out specific rules. These agreements can be bilateral, meaning made between two parties, for example, two states, or for example, Switzerland and the EU, where the EU would be considered as one party, or multilateral, meaning between more than two parties, normally quite a few parties. And they are normally made by states or state representatives who meet, negotiate and agree provisions in a similar way to making a contract, and then they sign the agreement, becoming a signatory to the agreement, and then next it's necessary to ratify the agreement. And this ratification process can differ from state to state, but normally, at least in the UK, this requires an Act of Parliament. Once the treaty has been ratified, it enters into force and it is binding on the parties to the treaty. Some treaties, such as the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, are firstly drafted by the International Law Commission, which is a subsidiary organ of the United Nations General Assembly, and it is in charge of developing and codifying international law. Treaties can cover a wide range of topics. Maybe you've heard of the Kyoto Protocol. This is an international treaty dealing with climate change, which commits state parties to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. Or perhaps if you're more interested in corporate law, you might have heard of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, otherwise known as GATT, which sets out rules for international trade and finance. Or maybe if you're interested in criminal law, you will have heard of the Rome Statute, which codified international crimes such as genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, as well as establishing the International Criminal Court in which to try such crimes. According to the principle of Pacta sunt servanda, which means treaties are to be honoured, parties to a treaty must comply with the provisions, and if they do not comply, then the treaty will be enforced. We'll talk a little bit more about enforcement mechanisms a bit later on. And as I mentioned, these treaties are binding on the parties to the treaty. However, these agreements may even eventually develop into something called customary international law. This means that they will become binding even on states who are not party to the agreement. And let's look at customary international law now. Customary law is the second source of law stated under Article 38 of the International Court of Justice Treaty, and it can be a little confusing. If you remember from podcast episode 24 about sources of law in the UK, I talked about customs, which are rules which develop over time but which aren't written down. And in the UK, some of these customs are part of the unwritten, uncodified constitution of the UK. Well, international customary law is like this, but of course at an international level. Customary law refers to legal rules which develop on a global or regional level due to a common practice amongst states. A number of factors are taken into consideration when determining whether a practice has indeed morphed into a customary law. Firstly, this is related to state practice. For example, how many states practice this custom? For how long have they practiced this custom? Is the practice consistent and uniform? And if the answer is, well, a lot of states seem to practice this, and they've done it for quite a long time, and they do it consistently, then it's more likely to be a customary law. But there's a second element as well, and this second element is known as opinio juris, and this relates to whether the practice is accepted as legally binding or as a legal obligation within the state, that we can clearly see that the state actually believes that this practice is indeed law. And this can be shown by legislation or through case law. And so if the practice is consistent, a lot of states do it, they've done it for a long time, and the practice is actually considered as part of their national legal system, then likely this practice will become a customary law. An example of customary law, just to make this a little bit clearer for you, is diplomatic immunity. This is a form of legal immunity which ensures that diplomats, such as ambassadors, are safe in a host state. They are safe in a secure sense, and they are free from prosecution or being subject to a court case, even if the diplomat's country is at war with the host state. By host state, I mean the state in which the foreign national, the ambassador, is based. This custom has been practiced for thousands of years, and in 1961 it was also codified in the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, being widely accepted as customary international law. So moving on, things get a little bit more blurry and elusive when we get onto the third main source of international law, and these are principles. According to Article 38 of the International Court of Justice Treaty, these are general principles of law recognised by civilised nations. Obviously, it's a difficult job to define what general principles are and, of course, what constitute civilised nations. And law theorists are in constant debate over this. However, these general principles can be helpful in dealing with international issues which are not already subject to an international treaty or binding customary rules. So after these three principal sources of law, we had conventions or treaties, customary law, and we also had principles, we also have subsidiary means of international law. And according to Article 38 of the International Court of Justice Treaty, these are firstly judicial decisions, and secondly, the teachings of the most highly qualified publicists of the various nations. So whilst these sources are not legally binding, they can be used to support the idea that a custom exists or to help with the interpretation of international law. We could, for example, read about different interpretations by legal scholars to help with the understanding of international law. And in addition to such sources, we have what's known as soft law, which refers to rules that are not strictly legally binding or enforceable, but are still relevant, for example, guidelines and policy declarations. So what about the relationship between international and national law? The main principle to consider here is that of sovereign equality. We've heard about sovereignty before in other podcast episodes, but what is sovereign equality in the context of international law? Well, according to sovereign equality, the state is first and foremost sovereign. This means that the state is only obligated to follow international laws it has agreed to and to comply with peremptory norms, also known as jus cogens or jus cogens, such as the prohibition of slavery, torture, and apartheid. If we look specifically at the UK, parliamentary sovereignty is always emphasised and international law must be enacted into national law for it to be valid. This way of dealing with international law is known as dualism, where international and national law are treated separately, as opposed to monism, where they are seen as a unity. You can see that in the UK, we treat it as completely separate to our national law, because for the international law to be valid, Parliament must pass an act. With regards to equality, sovereign equality, this means that all states are considered equal. And what do I mean by that? Well, this means that each nation is in control of its own national affairs, and no other state can dominate over another because each one is equal. Only under certain circumstances, such as with the regulation of transnational corporations, can one state exercise extraterritorial jurisdiction over another state, meaning that they can implement laws which have effect beyond their state borders and work in another jurisdiction. An example of a law with extraterritorial reach is the UK Bribery Act 2010, which is very far-reaching in its application, and this is because it has a legitimate purpose. It's aiming at eliminating bribery and corruption practices within corporations, not just in the UK, but on a wider scale. The concept of sovereignty has, of course, changed over time alongside the changing nature of what constitutes national and international matters. How a state treats its citizens is now not simply a matter of national interest, but it's a matter of international human rights law. And we saw in episode 38 about European human rights that the UK has certain human rights obligations because it is a party to the European Convention on Human Rights. So another example of the concept of sovereignty changing is that a state no longer can simply decide what it does to its forests, what it does to its oceans, what it does to its atmosphere, because, of course, these are now issues of global concern in relation to the environment and subject to international environmental law. Therefore, the relationship between national and international law is a complex one, which is continually changing. So let's move on. Why do states agree to limit themselves and comply with international law? Well, international laws exist for the benefit of the international community as a whole, and therefore abiding by the rules is ultimately in the interests of the individual state itself. the state that acts in a way to further the interests of others, is in fact ultimately serving its own self-interest. And this is known as enlightened self-interest. However, of course, without enforcement mechanisms, I'm a bit sceptical as to whether states would comply completely with international law. So, of course, there's an element of fear and of punishment. There are mechanisms which are there to enforce international law, and the fear of such mechanisms can act as a preventative measure to ensure state compliance. And the actual use of such mechanisms can even force a rogue state, a non-complying state, into compliance, perhaps because of the economic impact or the public discontent which could arise from such usage. Let's look at some of these mechanisms. So, sometimes treaties explicitly state the type of enforcement mechanism to be used in the event of a dispute, and the peaceful settlement of disputes is preferred. This may be, for example, through international arbitration, where parties agree to settle a dispute in an arbitration tribunal using the services of the Permanent Court of Arbitration, or other peaceful conciliation and resolution procedures. But where this is not the case, where it is not explicitly stated, some other options exist. Firstly, there is the concept of reciprocity. This means that if one state behaves in a certain way, the other state will respond in the same way. Secondly, there is the option of collective action. This is where a group of states respond collectively. For example, collectively adopting measures such as economic sanctions in order to compel compliance. Thirdly, there is the option of shaming. This is where a state brings shame on another country through negative publicity. Now, of course, these three measures are not exactly related explicitly to the law. So another option is the referral to an international court. We've mentioned in previous episodes the Court of Justice of the European Union and the European Court of Human Rights. But there are also the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court. So let's take a look at the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court. The International Court of Justice is the principal judicial organ of the United Nations, which was established in the UN Charter in 1945. It is responsible for settling disputes between member states that have submitted themselves to the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice, and it's based in The Hague in the Netherlands. The judgments of the International Court of Justice are binding on member states according to Article 94 of the UN Charter, and there is no option to appeal. So states have to comply with the judgment of the International Court of Justice. Moving on to the International Criminal Court, this was created by the Rome Statute in 1998, and it sits in The Hague as well, in the Netherlands, dealing with international criminal law, such as the investigation and trial of crimes which are deemed to be of concern to the international community. For example, those set out in the Rome Statute, which are genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. There is an important difference between the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court. The International Criminal Court can try individuals, whereas the International Court of Justice cannot. And therefore, prior to the International Criminal Court being established as a very permanent court, crimes were dealt with by ad hoc tribunals. and these were temporary courts with limited jurisdiction set up to deal with specific matters. It's important to take note of this distinction between the word court and tribunal in English. If you're a legal English translator, or you're simply working in the law and you want to get this term right, they have different meanings, and often a tribunal is something temporary, set up to deal with something specific, or it can deal with matters of first instance, being less formal than a court. For example, in the UK, we have national employment tribunals, which deal specifically with employment matters. So that brings us to the end of this episode. And of course, we could have gone into so much more detail because there's so much to talk about with international law. But of course, this was just a little taster, just an introduction. In future podcast episodes, we will, of course, come back to this topic and deal with it in much more detail. So, as I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, don't forget that if you're a Podcast Pro member, you can now take the exam for the English Legal System Module 2 Sources of Law course, and you can earn a certificate. So, good luck if you go ahead and do that. So, what exciting topic is coming next? Well, we will certainly have some more interviews coming up. And then the next major topic is to do with, wigs, gowns, special powers, and ancient mystical buildings. Can you guess what it is? Well, it sounds a little bit like the world of Harry Potter. However, it's far more exciting. We are going to be looking at the court system of England and Wales. Yes, that's right. What can be more exciting than that? Super exciting. So thank you for listening. Of course, if you've got any comments, please get in touch. You can email me at info@studylegalenglish.com and of course on Facebook and Twitter. So thanks for listening and see you next time.